watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, or Free Radio Asheville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, you will hear testimony from a landmark hearing that took place last Thursday in a small room in the basement of the U.S. Capitol. The hearing was chaired by Representative John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, ranking member of the Judiciary Committee. Its subject was recent secret official documents from the UK known as the Downing Street Minutes that were leaked to the British press in May and reported to you on this program at that time. The documents showed that the Bush-Cheney administration had a plan to fabricate evidence to justify invading Iraq, that the British government knew this and collaborated in the process. The Republican congressional leadership attempted to undermine Conyers' hearing by refusing to assign a proper hearing room and by scheduling a record number of floor votes in order to make it difficult for members to attend. The hearings addressed whether these Downing Street memos were sufficiently compelling to initiate impeachment of the Bush administration for lying to Congress in order to gain its backing for the invasion of Iraq. If you're a longtime listener to this program, you knew several years ago that the administration's justification for the invasion of Iraq was a lie, that the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan were on the table long before September 11th, that the September 11th attacks were part of a plan to push these invasions forward, not vice versa, and that the battle for the remainder of the world's cheap petroleum and the preservation of the wealth built on it is the motivation. What is notable about the hearings held last Thursday is that some members of Congress have now gone on record acknowledging the lies. And it becomes clear that many of them have known the administration was lying from the beginning. Longtime listeners to this program have been presented with the evidence that lies and corruption are standard operating procedure for the U.S. government and governments in general, for that matter. The concentration of such vast powers into the hands of a few virtually guarantees it. As President Coolidge once said, the business of America is business. But the present government is perhaps one of the most openly corrupt and thuggish in this country's history, and in possession of a level of technology that makes its ability to tyrannize unprecedented. Each time, and this has happened a few times during my lifetime, we hear somebody broach impeachment of a president whose actions have caused tremendous death and destruction with a statement to the effect that it's hard to imagine that the president would lie. It's not hard for me to imagine. Every single president during my lifetime has been a blood-stained, bought-and-paid-for liar, and my study of history has shown the past to be no different. Sometimes the lies come out during that president's administration, usually years afterward. But tomes have been written on all of this, and it is on the public record. Why, then, is someone always so shocked when the lies come to light? The powers that be, which includes the establishment press, define responsible conduct as that which does not undermine the legitimacy of the government system as a whole, does not expose the fabric of lies, the systemic corruption, does not challenge the fiction that we are the freest country in the world with a government of the people, by the people, and most of all, for the people. For example, facts justifying the impeachment of Reagan-Bush officials were on the table during the Iran-Contra affair in the 80s, but there was bipartisan collusion that another impeachment so soon after Nixon's would destroy the presidency as an institution. In other words, they refuse to enforce the law against Reagan and Bush, which has recycled most of its people back into the present administration. But they sure don't forget to enforce the law against a shoplifter. Lies always have a target. The deception is aimed at somebody. Since the lawmakers themselves are aware of the lies, it becomes clear that we, the American people, are the target of the lies. Why? They want us to believe in the law, because laws are for the little people. I promise you, you will hear a speech in the coming months containing words to the effect that no one is above the law. But that is nonsense. The rich and powerful are generally above the law because they make them, or by the people who make them. The laws are for us, to make us give our labor for their profits, empty our pockets into their coffers to fund their military-industrial complex, spill our blood in their wars to defend their access to profitable resources, which they equate with national security. And the worst of it is, even well-meaning people within the government see this as legitimate. A means justified by the ends. The ends being the preservation of order. A specific type of order. And this is why it always seems to take a so-called smoking gun to compel some measure of confronting the truth. Because the lies have become so obvious, so impossible to ignore, that the fundamentally corrupt nature of the system is at risk of being revealed if action is not taken. An instance of malfeasance will be dealt with publicly, leaving intact the underlying system which sprouts malfeasance the way sweaty tennis shoes sprout fungus. These Downing Street minutes are just such a smoking gun, and they further reveal the sham of the so-called rule of law. As we watch British officials scramble to cover their prime minister's bum by trying to create a pretext that will pass legal muster in order to justify what they know is a lawless attack of aggression, a war crime being planned against Iraq. This necessity to pretend to the rule of law, every once in a while, allows the rulers to be hoisted on their own petard. By leaking these Downing Street minutes, an unknown British civil servant has given us the tools to bring this country back from the brink of the Fourth Reich, if we have the will and the wit to use this gift. Pacifica Radio broadcast last Thursday's 3-hour hearings in their entirety. As I only have 2 hours for the program, I've attempted to preserve the most salient testimony. Mitch Jeserich of Free Speech Radio News anchored the hearings, and you will hear his voice identifying the speakers throughout the broadcast. We begin with Representative John Conyers' opening statement.
The Downing Street minutes will now come to order. Few issues are more important under our constitutional form of government than the decision to go to war and place our soldiers' lives at risk. It's no insignificant matter when in the fall of 2002, President Bush told us war would be the last resort. It's not unimportant when on March 6, 2003, the President promised us, "I've not made up my mind about military action. Hopefully, this can be done peacefully." Over the last 2 months, the veracity of these statements has, to put it mildly, come into question. On May 1st, the London Times released the now infamous Downing Street minutes in which the head of Britain's intelligence agency reported military action was now seen as inevitable, and intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. On May 29th, when further documents were released revealing that in the summer of 2002, British and United States aircraft had doubled their rates of bombing in Iraq in an apparent attempt to provoke an excuse for war. Last Sunday, the London Times released 6 new British intelligence documents indicating that as early as March 2002, our government had decided it would be necessary to create the conditions to justify war. Today, Newsweek is reporting that two high-ranking British officials confirmed that the 2002 Iraq's nuclear weapons program was effectively frozen and that there was no recent evidence tying Iraq to international terrorism, notwithstanding the administration's claims to the contrary. If these disclosures are true, and so far no one from the Bush administration has bothered to respond to our letters, they establish a prima facie case of going to war under false pretenses. This means that more than 1,600 brave Americans and hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis would have lost their lives for a lie. And that's why we're here today. This is why 122 members of Congress, which as of today includes the minority leader, have asked the president to explain his actions. That is why more than 550,000 Americans are joining us in petitions demanding answers from the administration. We are here today because many of us find it unacceptable for any administration, be it Democratic or Republican, to put our brave men and women in harm's way based on false information. The fact that our intelligence is out to be flawed in no way absolves those who would intentionally mislead our nations or its allies. We can't do anything in this hearing to change the facts and the problems on the ground in Iraq today, but we can pledge today to do everything within our power to find out how we got there and to make sure it never happens again. Attorney John Boniface is the founder and general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute, a prominent legal center in campaign finance reform field. In February and March of 2003, he served as lead counsel for a coalition of United States soldiers, parents of soldiers, and members of Congress in a federal lawsuit in which I and Representative Kucinich of Ohio were part of, challenging the authority of President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld to launch a war against Iraq absent a congressional declaration of war or equivalent action. Mr. Ray McGovern, a 27-year career as a CIA analyst, spanned administrations from John F. Kennedy to George H.W. Bush. His duties included at the CIA chairing national intelligence estimates, preparing the president's daily brief. These, the most authoritative genres of intelligence reporting, have been the focus of press reporting on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and on what the president was told before 9/11. During the mid-80s, Mr. McGovern was one of the senior analysts conducting early morning briefings for the president's daily brief. Mrs. Cindy Sheehan is the mother of Casey Austin Sheehan, age 24, killed in action in Iraq. Mrs. Sheehan founded the Gold Star Families for Peace in January 2005. The Gold Star Families for Peace is dedicated to bringing United States troops home immediately from Iraq. And our first witness, Ambassador Joseph Wilson, has been involved in international politics for more than 20 years. He served as the acting U.S. ambassador in Iraq during Operation Desert Shield and was the last American official to meet with Saddam Hussein before the first Gulf War. In 2002, at the request of Vice President Cheney, Mr. Wilson was assigned to the CIA to investigate whether Saddam Hussein was seeking to acquire uranium from Niger for the purpose of advancing his nuclear program. Mr. Wilson reported back to Washington that there was no basis for the claims. surprised that President Bush repeated that claim in his 2003 union address. Mr. Wilson wrote a New York Times op-ed piece asserting that the Bush administration had exaggerated the public case for invading Iraq. And shortly thereafter, White House officials called reporters to identify Mr. Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, as a clandestine CIA operative. Mr. Wilson also has a book out now, and we welcome him to begin the testimony. Welcome to this forum, sir.
Thank you, Congressman Conyers, and good afternoon. It's an honor to appear before this hearing to discuss the so-called Downing Street Memorandum of July 2002 and the assertion contained therein that in the Bush administration, the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. I served my country as a diplomat for almost 23 years, including tours in Niamey, Niger, and in Baghdad, Iraq, as Deputy Chief of Mission and Chargé d'Affaires, or Acting Ambassador, during the Desert Shield phase of the First Gulf War. I was also appointed Ambassador to Gabon and to the Democratic Republic of Sao Tome and Principe by President George Herbert Walker Bush, and concluded my public service career as Special Assistant to President Clinton and Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council. I am the recipient of numerous awards from the Department of State, as well as a Distinguished Defense Service Award from the Department of Defense for my service as political advisor to the Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Armed Forces in Europe during the deployment of American troops in Bosnia. The team I have always played for is America, not Republican, not Democrat, America. In February of 2002, I was asked by the CIA to meet with the American intelligence community officials charged with understanding Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs in order to discuss an intelligence report that had caught the attention of the Office of the Vice President. The report concerned the alleged sale of a significant amount of uranium yellowcake from the West African nation of Niger to Iraq. I was asked to attend this meeting because of my extensive experience in Niger and with the government that had been in power in that country during the time the supposed sale had taken place. Additionally, as the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has reported, I had previously traveled to Niger to look into other uranium-related matters. At this meeting, I was briefed that American intelligence had either seen or been briefed by a foreign intelligence service about the existence of documents purporting to be a memorandum of sale between Niger and Iraq. I did not see any documents, as I have said and written repeatedly. I understand they were not in the possession of the U.S. government at the time of the meeting. At the meeting, I was asked if I would consider traveling to Niger to try to find answers to lingering questions that analysts might have. That was the first time the suggestion of traveling to Niger was ever raised with me. There have been assertions that my wife, Valerie, a CIA operations officer in the counterproliferation area, suggested or recommended me for the trip. She did not. The CIA, a week after her identity was compromised by Robert Novak, told Newt Royce and Tim Phelps of Newsday that, quote, she did not recommend her husband to undertake the Niger assignment. They, the officers who did ask Wilson to check the uranium story, were aware of who she was married to, which is not surprising. There are people elsewhere in government who are trying to make her look like she was the one who was cooking this up, he, the CIA spokesman, said. I can't understand why. The CIA has repeated this denial to all who have asked since, including David Ensor of CNN and Doyle McManus of the Los Angeles Times. She was not at the meeting where the trip was first raised with me. There have been questions raised about why the CIA would send a, quote, known Bush critic, unquote, to quote Robert Novak, to undertake this mission. My trip to Niger took place towards the end of February 2002, almost 6 months before I first shared my concerns about the regime change by military action approach of the administration. I went to Niger because of questions raised by the intelligence report and the concerns of the Office of the Vice President were legitimate and needed to be checked out. This was not a partisan question, but one impacting national security. Weapons of mass destruction exploding in American cities will kill Americans, not Republicans or Democrats, but Americans. Even when I did begin to question the administration's approach, as I first wrote in an article published in the San Jose Mercury News on October 13, 2002, I acknowledged the importance of dealing with the threat I, like so many, believed his arsenal of weapons of mass destruction posed to the region and to our own national security. I traveled to Niger, spent 8 days there meeting with former members of the Niger government, and satisfied myself that their answers, coupled with the structure of the mining industry, about which I knew quite a bit, and the government decision-making process, made it highly unlikely that such a transaction had ever taken place. There were two other inquiries made at approximately the same time. Our ambassador in Niger at the time, Barbara Owens Kirkpatrick, and the deputy commander-in-chief of U.S. Armed Forces in Europe, Marine Corps General Carlton Fulford, who also traveled to Niger, reported that it was highly unlikely that such a sale had occurred. There were, accordingly, three reports on the subject in the files of the U.S. government by mid-March 2002. Parenthetically, there are those who have questioned my qualifications to make these inquiries, noting that I am not a CI officer nor an expert on weapons of mass destruction. Those assertions are true. I am, however, an expert on Niger and know quite a bit about uranium mining in Africa, having served in three countries in Africa in which uranium is mined, including as Ambassador Gabon, where the mining industry structure is similar to that in Niger. Uranium yellowcake is the result of the separation of ore from rock in which it is found. It is a mining question, not a nuclear weapons question. My particular value added to the U.S. government's understanding of the issue was my knowledge of the country, its mining industry, and my long relationship with key players in Niger's politics. Quite simply, I knew them far better than our ambassador, who had arrived only during the transition process to a new government. I reported back to the CIA after having also briefed the ambassador and embassy officials in Niger and went back to my private life. In January 2003, the President of the State of the Union address uttered the now infamous 16 words, "The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa." At the time, I was mildly curious about the assertion, but given that three other countries produce uranium, South Africa, Namibia, and Gabon, I did not immediately conclude that the President had been speaking about Niger. I did take the initiative to call the State Department Bureau of African Affairs to remind them of my trip and to suggest that if the President had been speaking about Niger, either he had information about which I was not aware, or else the record needed to be corrected. I was told that perhaps he had been speaking about another country. Unbeknownst to me, the State Department in December 2002 had published a white paper in which it claimed that Saddam had failed to come clean on his efforts to purchase uranium from Africa in the direct declaration submitted to the United Nations as required by UN Security Council Resolution 1441. However, the Niger claim was quickly removed from subsequent iterations of the U.S. Bill of Particulars against Iraq because it was not credible. After the publication of the State Department paper and again after the President's State of the Union address, it has been reported that the International Atomic Energy Agency asked the U.S. government for information related to the charges made. After the second request, documents purporting to be the memorandum of sale of uranium from Niger to Iraq were delivered to the IAEA. In March 2003, Dr. Mohamed El-Baradei, the Director General of the IAEA, testified to the UN Security Council that the documents had been deemed by that agency to be forgeries. His deputy, Jacques Bote, was even more candid, commenting that they were so replete with errors that a two-hour search on Google would have sufficed to discredit them. The U.S. government, in response, was a statement, "We fell for it." It was at that point that I became aware that the President's State of the Union assertion was based on the Niger claim. For the next 3 months, I privately urged the administration through contacts and third parties to correct the record. I also shared what I knew with Nick Kristof of the New York Times and Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, as well as with several Democratic senators, and I met with the staffs of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. I took this initiative for one simple reason. It is my firm belief that the most solemn decision a government in our democracy ever has to make is that decision to send our soldiers to die and to kill in the name of our country. In making that decision, we deserve a debate based on facts, not on information that is thrown into the debate, not because it is true, but because it supports a political decision that has already been made. In mid-June, Condoleezza Rice, then the National Security Advisor, in response to a question from Tim Russert on Meet the Press, asserted with respect to what the White House knew about the Niger matter that maybe somebody in the bowels of the agency knew something about it, but nobody in her circle. It was clear to me then, and later confirmed by a senior State Department official, that if the truth were to come out, I would have to write it myself. I did so in an article published in the New York Times on July 6, 2003, entitled "What I Did Not Find in Africa." In it, I wrote, "The question now is how that answer to the question of Niger uranium sales to Iraq was or was not used by our political leadership." If my information was deemed inaccurate, I understand, though I would be very interested to know why. If, however, the information was ignored because it did not fit certain preconceptions about Iraq, then a legitimate argument can be made that we went to war under false pretenses. At a minimum, Congress, which authorized the use of military force at the president's behest, should want to know if the assertions about Iraq were warranted. I further wrote in the same article, America's foreign policy depends on the sanctity of its information. For this reason, questioning the selective use of intelligence to justify the war in Iraq is neither idle sniping nor revisionist history. As Mr. Bush has suggested, the act of war is the last option of a democracy, taken when there is a grave threat to our national security. More than 200 soldiers have lost their lives in Iraq already. We have in duty to ensure that their sacrifice came for the right reasons. The next day, the White House acknowledged to a Washington Post reporter, Walter Pincus, that the 16 words did not rise to the level of inclusion in the State of the Union address. Within days, it became clear that the Director of Central Intelligence had warned the administration nearly 4 months before the State of the Union not to use the Niger claim, and had warned that the president not be a witness of fact because, as he subsequently testified, the case was weak and the American intelligence community believed the British had exaggerated the claim. Indeed, at roughly the same time Mr. Tenet was sending faxes and telephoning the White House in early October 2002, his deputy was telling the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that the American intelligence community believed the British had, quote, stretched the case on African uranium sales to Iraq. Stephen Hadley, then the Deputy National Security Advisor, offered to resign when the evidence of phone calls and faxes from the Director of Central Intelligence became public. And Condoleezza Rice even offered an apology to Gwen Ifill on PBS, of PBS. At the same time, of course, the administration launched a campaign to defame and discredit me by compromising the identity of my wife as a CIA operative, although, frankly, being married to her is hardly anything that compromises me or anything that I'm ashamed of. Indeed, I'm proud of it. Whatever damage the administration and its allies in the Republican National Committee and the right-wing echo chamber have done to my family and me, however, is nothing compared to what has been done to our soldiers and their families with this war. Now, with the publication of the so-called Downing Street memo, as well as the subsequent documents that have appeared in the British press, it is increasingly clear that the intelligence and the facts were indeed being fixed around the policy, and that we sent our troops to war under dubious pretenses. We're having this discussion today because we failed to have it 3 years ago in the run-up to the war. It would appear from the information that has been made public over the past 2 years, including the Downing Street memo, that the administration may have been less than candid with Congress as it considered that most important of decisions, voting to go to war. Even today, however belatedly, it is an important dialogue as it touches on everything a democracy stands for. It used to be said that democracies are difficult to mobilize for war precisely because of the nature of debate required in the run-up to such a decision. Indeed, that is one of the reasons often put forward for championing progress towards democratic governance. If the administration circumvented that requirement for open debate before going to a war with Iraq, then the public needs to understand why, if we have hoped to avoid making the same mistake again. At the same time, we must not take our eye off the ball in Iraq. The situation is a mess, and by all accounts, not soon to improve. We were told in the run-up to the war that there would be fewer than 30,000 troops in Iraq within a year of the invasion. There are four times that many there now. We are now told that we must stay lest the country fall into sectarian violence, but it is in the midst of sectarian strife as we speak, and there is no reason to believe that our departure now or 5 years from now will change the nature of that violence. Our continued presence will, however, guarantee more American deaths and more people who hate us for what we have done and from whose ranks increasing numbers of terrorists will be drawn. I don't have the answer, but I do believe that the time has come for us to ask the question, is our presence in Iraq part of the solution or part of the problem? And in answering that question, I believe we should elicit the views of Iraq's neighbors, our allies, the international community at large, and experts in this country, and not just the same cabal of ideologues whose policy prescriptions foisted upon a frightened nation in the aftermath of the terrible tragedy of 9/11 have been shown to be so terribly flawed. I have brought copies of the two articles I cited in this statement and would ask that they be made part of the record.
Without objection, so ordered. I want to thank you so much, Ambassador Wilson, for starting us off. We'll now call on the founder of the Gold Star Families for American Peace, Mrs. Cindy Sheehan. Welcome to this forum.
Thank you, Sam Conyers. I wish I could say it was an honor to be here today to testify about the effect that the revelations of the Downing Street memo has had on me and my family. It is an honor that I wish never had to happen. I believe that not any of us should be gathered here today for this reason, as a result of an invasion occupation that never should have happened. My son, Specialist Casey Austin Sheehan, was killed in action in Sadr City, Baghdad on 04-04-04. He was in Iraq for only 2 weeks before L. Paul Bremer inflamed the Shiite militia into rebellion, which resulted in the deaths of Casey and six other brave soldiers who were tragically killed in an ambush. My friend Bill Mitchell, the father of Sergeant Mike Mitchell, who was one of the other soldiers killed that awful day, is here with us today. How many of you have ever seen your child in his or her premature coffin? It is a shocking and very painful sight. The most tragic irony is that if the Downing Street memo proves to be true, Casey and thousands of people should still be alive. The leadership of this country rushed us into an illegal invasion of another sovereign country on prefabricated and cherry-picked intelligence. Iraq was no threat to the United States of America, and the devastating sanctions and bombing raids against Iraq were working. As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I have that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president. From the expose of the Downing Street memo and the conversations with George Bush from 1999, it seems like the invasion of Iraq and the deaths of so many innocent people were preordained. It appears that my boy Casey was given a death sentence even before he joined the Army in May of 2000. When a president lies to Congress and the American people, it is a serious offense. If the Downing Street memo proves to be true, then it would appear that the president, vice president, and many members of the cabinet deceived the world before the invasion of Iraq. As a result of this alleged lie, over 1,700 brave young Americans who were only trying to do their duties have come home in flag-draped coffins. Images, as if they were ashamed of our children, that our leaders won't even let the American public see. Thousands upon thousands of Iraqis who were guilty only of the crime of living in Iraq are dead. Thousands of our young people will go through the rest of their lives missing one or more limbs, and too many will come home missing parts of their souls and humanity. Kevin Lucy, who found his Marine son Jeffrey, who was recently home from Iraq, hanging dead from a garden hose in his basement, wrote to me, quote, "We ask daily, where was the urgency? Where was the necessity of rushing in? Can anyone explain to us, his mother and to his father, as to why he felt that he had to die by his own hand? Why are the ones in position of power so afraid to ask people like us to discuss what happened to Jeff? Jeff can teach us so much. This war was so misguided and had so many other agendas which had nothing to do with the country," end quote. Kevin, who cradled his son when he was his sweet baby boy, cradled Jeff's lifeless body for the last time in his arms after he cut him down from the hose. The Jeff that the Lucy saw march off to a reckless war was not the one who limped home. The Jeff his family knew died in Iraq, murdered by the inhumanity of gratuitous war. The deceptions and betrayals that led to the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq cost my family a price too dear to pay and almost too much to bear. The precious and young life of Casey. Casey was a good soldier who loved his family, his community, his country, and his God. He was trustworthy and trusting, and the leadership of his country seemingly betrayed him. He was an indispensable part of our family, an obedient, sweet, funny, and loving son to myself and his father, Pat, an adored big brother to his sisters Carly and Jane, and his brother Andy, and the beloved nephew to my sister, Auntie, who is here with me today. Our family has been devastated and torn asunder by his murder. I believe that the reasons that we citizens of the United States of America were given for the invasion of Iraq have unequivocally been proven to be false. I also believe that Casey and his buddies have been killed to line the pockets of already wealthy people and to feed the insatiable war machine that has always devoured our young. Casey died saving his buddies, and I know so many of our brave young soldiers died doing the same thing. But he and his fellow members of the military should never have been sent to Iraq. I know the family of Sergeant Sherwood Baker, who was killed guarding a team that was looking for the mythic WMDs in Baghdad. The same WMDs that were the justification for invading Iraq as outlined in the Downing Street memo. Sherwood's brother Dante Zapala and his dad Al Zapala are here with us today. I believe the Downing Street memo proves that our leaders betrayed too many innocents into an early grave. The lives of the ones left behind are shattered almost beyond repair. I also believe an investigation into the Downing Street memo is completely warranted and the necessary first step into righting the wrong that is Iraq and holding someone accountable for the needless, senseless, and avoidable deaths of many thousands. As far as I am concerned, it doesn't matter if one is a Democrat or a Republican. A full investigation into the veracity of the Downing Street memo must be initiated immediately. Casey was not asked his political affiliation before he was sent to die in Iraq. The innocent people who are having their blood shed by the buckets full in Iraq don't even know or care what American partisan politicking is all about. Every minute that we waste in gathering signatures on petitions or arguing about partisan politics, more blood is being spilled in Iraq. How many more families here in America are going to get the visit from the Grim Reaper dressed in a U.S. military uniform while we are trying to get our congressional leadership to do their duties to the Constitution and to the people of America? I believe that Congress expediently abrogated their constitutional responsibility to declare war when they passed the War Powers Act, and they bear at least some responsibility for the needless heartache wrought on this world by our government. I believe that supporting a full investigation into the Downing Street beginning for Congress to redeem itself for abandoning the Constitution and the American people. There are too many stories of heartache and loss to tell at a hearing like this. I have brought testimonies of other families who have been devastated by the war. Their soldiers' names are Sergeant Sherwood Baker, killed in action 042604. First Lieutenant Neil Santoriello, killed in action 081304. Sergeant Mike Mitchell, killed in action 040404. Specialist Casey Sheehan, also killed in action 040404. Lieutenant Jeff Kaler, killed in action 040703. Specialist Kevin S.K. Wessel, killed in action 041905. Specialist Jonathan Castro, killed in action 122104. Private First Class William Pritchard, killed in action 021104. Specialist Joseph Blickenstaff, killed in action 120803. And First Lieutenant Kenneth Ballard, killed in action 053004. I would like to have the testimonies put into the record and recorded for all to read the words of boundless love, bottomless loss, and deep despair.
Without objection, so ordered.
There are a few people around the U.S. and a couple of my fellow witnesses who are a little justifiably worried that in my anger and anguish over Casey's premeditated death, I would use some swear words, as I have been known to do on occasion when speaking about the subject. Mr. Conyers, out of my deep respect for you, the other representatives here, my fellow witnesses, and viewers of these historic proceedings, I was able to make it through an entire testimony without using any profanity. However, if anyone deserves to be angry and use profanity, it is I. What happened to Casey and humanity because of the apparent dearth of honesty in our country's leadership is so profane that it defies even my vocabulary skills. We as Americans should be offended more by the profanity of the actions of this administration than by swear words. We have all heard the old adage that actions speak louder than words, and for the sake of Casey and our other precious children, please hold someone accountable for their actions and their words of deception. Again, I would like to thank you for inviting me to testify today and giving me a chance to tell my story, which is a tragic story of too many families here in the U.S. and in Iraq. I hope and pray that this is the first step in exposing the lies to the light and bringing justice for the ones who can no longer speak for themselves. More importantly, I hope this is a step in bringing our other children home from Iraq. Thank you.
Very well said. We'll try to meet all of the commitments that you'd like us to. Mrs. Sheehan, we thank you so much. The next witness is Mr. Ray McGovern.
By now you know what the Downing Street minutes say. Let me focus in on the phrase, the intelligence and facts were fixed around the policy. How exactly is this fixing accomplished? Well, rather than speak in generalities, let's do AOL. Let's do the anatomy of a lie. We'll take just one. You have to pay a little bit of attention here because it flows through a chronology. Here's how it works. On August 26, 2002, less than 5 weeks after the briefing at 10 Downing Street, Vice President Cheney gave a major speech in which he said, and I quote, "We now know that Saddam has resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. Among other sources, we've gotten this from the firsthand testimony of defectors, including Saddam's own son-in-law." This was a lie. Saddam's son-in-law, Hussein Kamil, told us just the opposite when he defected in 1995. Again, he told us just the opposite. You can find it on page 13 of his debriefing report. He said, and I quote, "All weapons, biological, chemical, missile, nuclear, were destroyed," end quote. How did Kamil know this? He was in charge. They were destroyed in July of 1991 at his order. Why? To prevent the UN inspectors from finding them after the war. And everything else Hussein Kamil told us checked out to be true. Now, Cheney's lie would have been able to stand were it not for the conscience of another patriotic whistleblower who gave the text of Kamil's debriefing to Newsweek 4 weeks before the war, as the drumbeat for war got louder and louder in early 2003. Newsweek broke the story on February 24th, 2003, several weeks before the attack, but the information was suppressed by U.S. media. When Reuters asked then-CIA spokesman Bill Harlow about it, he used his entire tray of adjectives, branding this report incorrect, bogus, wrong, and untrue. The British government took the same line. It mattered not that the evidence was documentary from the official debriefing report of Kamil. So that's how it works, folks. That's how you fix intelligence. All you need is chutzpah, a very flexible attitude toward truth, slumbering watchdog intelligence committees in the Congress, and a supine press eager to accept official explanations no matter how disingenuous. Cheney played a superb role in fabricating out of whole cloth a nuclear threat from Iraq, putting wind behind all those mushroom clouds conjured up by the president and Condoleezza Rice to deceive you, the Congress, our elected representatives. Now, in a 27-year career in intelligence, one encounters many examples of attempts to trim the truth, or as the British minutes put it, fix the intelligence and facts around the policy. It's in the woodwork. It's part of the political scene. But I had never known fixing to include the vice president arrogating the right to turn a key piece of intelligence on its head. Nor had I in all those years ever known a sitting vice president to make multiple visits to CIA headquarters to make sure the fix was in. And this is just one example. There is no word to describe the reaction of us professional intelligence officers, active and retired, to the reality that Our intelligence community managers were eager to participate in this deceit, into this deliberate subversion of the oath we all take, the oath we all take to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. Now, we're not talking about Georgetown parlor games here, or worse still, White House fraternity jokes. These are consequential, death-dealing lies. The establishment was all yucking it up at the annual dinner of the radio and TV news correspondents on March 24th, 2004, as photos showed the president looking under the office furniture and around his desk. Are there some weapons of mass destruction here, or maybe they're over there? Ha, ha, ha. And y'all laughed with him, folks. Y'all laughed with him. I'll tell you who's not laughing. Cindy's not laughing. The father and brother of Specialist or Sergeant Sherwood Baker's not laughing. Cindy's son was killed 11 days after the show put on by the president looking for weapons of mass destruction. Sergeant Baker was killed 33 days after that big joke. And 4 months after David Kay came back from Iraq and told us all there were no weapons of mass destruction. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. That's the scriptural verse chiseled into the marble at CIA headquarters. Well, thanks to the Downing Street minutes, we now know the truth. And the question for us is whether we have enough respect for the Constitution, whether we have enough courage that we will pursue the purveyors of consequential falsehood so that the truth can truly make us free. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll hear from John Bonifaz.
Thank you, Congresswoman Waters, Congressman Conyers, members of the committee. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for hosting this forum today. My name is John Bonifaz. I am a Boston-based attorney specializing in constitutional litigation and the co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org. While it is also true, as Congressman Conyers referenced in the opening, that I serve as general counsel for the National Voting Rights Institute, I am here in my private capacity as a constitutional attorney in Boston and as the co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org. AfterDowningStreet.org is a national coalition of veterans groups, peace groups, public interest organizations, and ordinary citizens across this country calling for a formal congressional investigation into whether the President of the United States has committed impeachable offenses in connection with the Iraq War. We launched this campaign on May 26th of this year in response to the revelations which have emerged from the release of the Downing Street minutes. The recent release of the Downing Street minutes provides new and compelling evidence that the President of the United States has been actively engaged in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war against Iraq. If true, such conduct constitutes a high crime under Article 2, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, which states, "The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors." As has previously been stated, the Downing Street minutes reveal that by the summer of 2002, President Bush had decided to overthrow Iraqi President Saddam Hussein by launching a war which Richard Dearlove, the senior British intelligence officer, reports would be, quote, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, weapons of mass destruction. Dearlove continues, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. The framers of the United States Constitution drafted Article 2, Section 4 to ensure that the people of the United States, through their representatives in the United States Congress, could hold a president accountable for an abuse of power and an abuse of the public trust. James Madison, speaking at Virginia's ratifying convention, stated, "A president is impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution." Alexander Hamilton, writing in The Federalist, stated that the impeachment is for the misconduct of public men from the abuse or violation of some public trust. James Iredell, who later became a justice of the United States Supreme Court, stated at North Carolina's ratifying convention, "The president must certainly be punishable for giving false information to the Senate. He is to regulate all intercourse with foreign powers, and it is his duty to impart to the Senate every material intelligence he receives." Iredell went on to say that if the president, quote, has concealed important intelligence which he ought to have communicated, and by that means induced the Congress to enter into measures injurious to their country, and which they would not have consented to had the true state of beings been disclosed to them, end quote, then he says that ought to be considered an impeachable offense. On July 25th, 1974, then Representative Barbara Jordan spoke to her colleagues on the House Judiciary Committee of the constitutional basis for impeachment. "The powers relating to impeachment," Jordan said, "are an essential check in the hands of this body, the legislature, against and upon the encroachment of the executive. Impeachment," she added, "is chiefly designed for the president and his high ministers to somehow be called into account. It is designed to bridle the executive if he engages in excesses. It is designed as a method of national inquest into the conduct of public men. The framers confined in the Congress the power," Representative Barbara Jordan said, "if need be, to remove the president in order to strike a delicate balance between a president swollen with power and grown tyrannical and preservation of the independence of the executive." The question must now be asked, with the release of the Downing Street minutes, whether the president has committed impeachable offenses. Is it a high crime to engage in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for taking the nation into war? Is it a high crime to manipulate intelligence so as to allege falsely a national security threat posed to the United States as a means of trying to justify a war against another nation based on preemptive purposes? Is it a high crime to commit a felony via the submission of an official report to the United States Congress falsifying the reasons for launching military action? Congressman Conyers, members of the committee, the Downing Street minutes shed new and important light on a document the president himself submitted to the United States Congress within 48 hours after having launched the invasion of Iraq. This is the document, and I have distributed it to all of you, and I've asked that it be put into the record of these proceedings. In the letter, dated March 18, 2003, the president makes a formal determination, as required by the joint resolution on Iraq passed by the United States Congress in October 2002, that military action against Iraq was necessary to, quote, protect the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq. He also states in this letter to Congress that military action was consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. If the evidence revealed by the Downing Street minutes is true, then the president's submission of his March 18, 2003 letter to the United States Congress would violate federal criminal law, including the federal anti-conspiracy statute, which makes it a felony, quote, to commit any offense against the United States or to defraud the United States or any agency thereof in any manner or for any purpose, and the False Statements Accountability Act of 1996, which makes it a felony to issue knowingly and willfully false statements to the United States Congress. The United States House of Representatives has a constitutional duty to investigate fully and comprehensively the evidence revealed by the Downing Street minutes and other related evidence, and to determine whether there are sufficient grounds to impeach George W. Bush, the President of the United States. A resolution of inquiry is the appropriate first step in launching this investigation. The Iraq War has led to the deaths of more than 1,700 United States soldiers and tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians. Thousands more have been permanently and severely injured on both sides. More than 2 years after the invasion, Iraq remains unstable and its future unclear. The war has already cost the American people tens of billions of taxpayer dollars at the expense of basic human needs here at home. More than 135,000 United States soldiers remain in Iraq without any stated exit plan. If the president has committed high crimes in connection with this war, he must be held accountable. The United States Constitution demands no less. Thank you.
And that was John Bonifaz, co-director of After Down Your Street. Bonifaz. You are listening to Down Your Street hearing here on
and
Capitol
I thank
Hill.
All of the witnesses John Conyers for their testimony.
Is chairing
I'm going
the
to
hearing.
Begin with a couple questions, and then I'd like all of my colleagues to join in with any statements or questions that they may have. And here's a question to all four of you. The Downing Street minutes outline this administration's deliberate intention to manipulate intelligence in order to justify a predetermined policy of war against Iraq. Some in the media have suggested these revelations are nothing new. What do the Downing Street minutes tell us that we did not know before they were revealed? If you have a view about that, please come forward. Ambassador.
Let me begin, if I may, Congressman. Thank you. A year
Ambassador
after
Joe
the Downing
Wilson.
Street memo appeared, I asked the question in my New York Times article, was the U.S. fixing the intelligence, essentially? It's very clear to me that in July 2002, at the very highest levels of the British government, they had concluded that that was the case, that war was inevitable and the facts were being fixed around the policy. Now, there have been a number of articles that suggest that nothing was new, that we knew all that at the time. Indeed, yesterday there was an opinion piece in the Washington Post that suggested all that. I would submit, sir, that that I don't think that Jim Baker would have written his piece, which was written after July of 2002, nor would Brent Scowcroft have written his piece. Both were senior advisors to President George Herbert Walker Bush. I may not have written the piece that I wrote in October of that year had I believed that, in fact, the cards had already been dealt. General Anthony Zinni, who was the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM, which has that particular part of the world in its region, may well not have participated in the debate until December had he known. Indeed, he told me, and I've put it in my book, that that he left the debate in December, 6 months after the Downing Street memos, because in his judgment at that time, the decisions had all been made.
You remind me that many members of Congress said if they had known this before we voted to give the president additional military authority in Iraq, he might not have gotten any votes or certainly very few had this knowledge been available to us then.
Of course, Paul Wolfowitz, then the Deputy Secretary of Defense, was
Professor
quoted in Vanity Fair as having said, we settled on weapons of mass destruction because that was something that we could sell.
Right.
You're listening to excerpts from a hearing chaired by Congressman John Conyers last Thursday in Washington on the Downing Street memos. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, 88.1, Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1, KRFP, Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP, Salida, WGDR, Plainfield, or Free Radio Asheville. We continue.
Mr. McGovern.
Apropos your remark about congressmen and senators feeling misled, I would point out that even Senator Pat Roberts, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, no liberal he, has admitted that had he known some of the things that came out since, he has strong doubts as to whether there would have been a vote for war.